It's a hard one.
I had a headache to start with.
And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 982.
Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Senate Bill 982, we first heard this bill on May 21st. It updates the definition of telecommunications and telecommunication service in statutes related to the regulation of telecommunications utilities. You have in front of you two sets of amendments. The Dash 4 amendment adds the provisions of Senate Bill 863A into the measure, which prohibits what's known as robocalls, which are automatic calls made from the usage of dialing and announcing devices. And you also have the Dash 5 amendment, which is identical to the Dash 4 amendment, but removes the emergency clause that's on the Dash 4 amendment. And you also have a staff measure summary in your packet on Senate Bill 863A to give you further background information.
And my intention today is to just amend the bill with the Dash 5 amendments. So if anyone's here to talk about anything else other than the original substance of the bill or Dash 5, I think you're all out of luck. If I hear otherwise, I'm going to call Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. And if it pleases the chair, I'd also like at this time to ask Mr. Shepherd from the Department of Justice to come forward to be here because there may be some questions that will arise, and I think he would be very helpful on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for hearing the amendment to Senate Bill 982. Mr. Chair, of course, you recognize that as you are the chief co-sponsor of Senate Bill 863, which passed the Senate and somehow disappeared in another committee, and I really appreciate the opportunity to bring this bill forward to you. To give you just a little background, in October of last year, I was in Bismarck, North Dakota on business, and I was speaking to a senator about some of the things that were going on in the capital city, and he told me how they had just, in that state, banned robocalls, the automated dialing calls. And I said, well, that's kind of really interesting, and, you know, our Constitution probably can't ban those in our state, although people would love to do that. And I said, how did you do that? He said, well, you know, 98% of my people hate them. You know, I said, it's really easy. I said, well, who are the other 2%? And he pointed at the Capitol building. The only people that oppose this are the people in that Capitol building and who, you know, make the Capitol run. And I think you will find today that that's the same in the state of Oregon, about the only people that really, really have a real passion, although it's a rather interesting one, is the people that are involved in that business and involved in our business. And I think at one level, I think we have to ask ourselves, I mean, in terms of privacy and in terms of free speech and communications, with the no-call list and other protections that we in this legislature and on a federal level say are important for our citizens, it's almost arrogant, though, to say that we should have a right to invade that privacy, but nobody else should. You have a packet that my staff put together, Rebecca and Ryan. For this committee today, I didn't bring all, you know, the witnesses. Instead, I wanted to refer you to some of the written documentation that we had in the Senate. You may have noticed this in some of your Capitol clips. I mean, the Walla Walla Union did an editorial in support of this Oregon bill just last week, and I don't know where they hear about these things, but it's right now, almost 15 different states have either banned or severely limited the use of automated dialing devices. Some states are currently doing that right now. Nebraska just voted last week to limit their use. Same with the state of Florida. And there's a reason for it, and I think we all understand. One in your packet, you have a copy of the New York Times front page article on this issue just a few weeks ago, and it talks about the story of Scott Glebe, who was running for Congress in the state of Nebraska. At 3 in the morning, the constituents in his congressional district received a phone call saying, hi, I'm Scott Glebe. I'm running for Congress. And as you might imagine, the constituents were not exactly pleased at 3 in the morning to be getting that call, and he ended up losing the election, at least in part, because of that offense. The problem was, as you might have guessed, it was not Mr. Scott Glebe who placed that call. Someone had taken his voice, made a robocall, and because of the rules are so broad that you are not able to trace who did that call, who made the call, where the call came from, and by the time the election was over, for even the constituency to know that that wasn't him. Now, we'd like to think that doesn't ever happen, but one of the realities is this is a growing issue. It's getting stronger all the time. You'll hear people talk about, well, this is an inexpensive way to communicate. Well, that's a blessing, and it's also a curse. It's a blessing because it gives a way to communicate. The curse is it opens it up to more and more invasion of the privacy of our individual citizens and for the misuse of that technology. When 863 originally began, members of the committee, it came with a constitutional amendment working with Pete Shepard and the Department of Justice. Because of our constitution, which you know, free speech is a very, very a much broader constitution than most states' constitutions, to really severely limit the use of robocalls. We decided not to go that way because it is, let's face it, a huge hurdle, you know, put something on the ballot and change the constitution. So instead, I worked with Mr. Shepard after we had our first public hearing in the Senate Business and Transportation Committee and said, would you go through this bill? Let's find those areas in which we do not need a constitutional change, at least to provide some transparency and some honesty in the use of automated dialing devices. Let me tell you what the bill does and what it does not. The bill does not ban the use of automated robocalls. I would like to have that happen, frankly, but it does not ban the use of automated calls. It does not restrict those who have business relationships. It follows exactly the pattern of the current national do not call list and the same exceptions for public safety and schools. It doesn't change that. It doesn't change the fact that you can still call personally. At least they'll have an opportunity to talk to their real legislator or whoever that may be. You can have an opportunity to have a conversation or hang up on somebody rather than just an automated device. It doesn't stop anybody from doing phone banks. It doesn't stop anybody, even if they are on a national do not call list, if you have talked to them at their doorstep or at a town hall and they've asked to have information from you, you can add them back to the list. What it does do, and this is what's really important, it takes away the fact that our only contact with people has to be by some automated device, and you can lock your door and shut your windows, and somehow we're still going to be able to penetrate them because we are different than every other business that we have regulated and said, no, privacy is important, except for us and except for those in the political process. Here are the specific limitations, and Mr. Shepard, I think, will answer any questions you may have as well. This is what the bill does. Number one, it says that if you use an automated dialing device, it must disconnect within 10 seconds after the subscriber hangs up. What does that mean? When you pick up the phone and you have this message, this automated device message, and you hang up, some unscrupulous users of this technology will, quote, grab the line. That is, you cannot get a dial tone. So you get back on. Have you ever had that happen? And you can't get the dial tone. And they'll hold it and they'll hold it. Ironically, 2 days after this passed the Oregon Senate, one of the prominent members of the press here at the state capitol said they got robocalled at that particular newspaper, and they grabbed the line. And they could not make outgoing calls or incoming calls for a period of time. It bans that. Number two, it says you cannot misrepresent who you are. You can't pull a Scott Gleeb if this bill passes, colleagues, and say, you know, I am Representative Berger or I'm Representative Schaffler, et cetera, et cetera. You cannot misrepresent who you are or misrepresent who you're calling about. It also says that you cannot incur a charge for the subscriber. That is, calling your cell phone and what you have to pay per minute and put those types of calls in which you then have this harm, the harm of having to pay for that response. Those are things that it does. And the final issue, is I think I have this right, Mr. Shepard, is that you cannot manipulate the caller ID. One of the general traditions of this, we see it here, let's face it, and this is what happened with Mr. Cleed, is that we say, well, who's calling me? And they manipulate the caller ID so it says something like 00000, et cetera, so you have no idea. And no one is accountable for that call. No one is accountable. So when you look at what the bill does, those are the specific harms. And the final one is people who are on a no-call list also cannot be called unless they specifically, as I mentioned earlier, you know, say, hey, I do want to be called. And I would think about, colleagues, one of the issues here is, first of all, the wisdom of actually calling somebody with an automated device who has proactively taken the time to fill out a form to say, please don't call me. I'm not sure that's a wise thing to do anyway. Now, will this make it tougher on some people running political campaigns? Yes, if their whole campaign is using automated devices rather than real personal contact with our constituents and people that want to know what's going on and want to communicate with us. It makes you might work a little harder to actually talk to people to build a list that might have some of those individuals who are on a no-call list that you would like to add. Yes. Does it affect the use of the automated call, though? It does not. It does not does not affect your ability to call someone else, your phone bank. It simply puts some limitations, a few limitations, sideboards, on the ability to invade the privacy of citizens that we have already said is a harm to businesses and why we have the state and national no-call list. I think it's very good public policy. I think you will find that 98% of your constituents, if you were to poll them, as we did, absolutely hate these. But I will tell you the 2% who actually fight this bill, and I will tell you in our Senate committee, to be totally candid, I see a couple of people signed up, refuse to sign up and actually testify why they should have a right to invade the privacy or no one else should. But the opposition is strong on the, I think, on the platform of the people who utilize these calls. But that doesn't make it good public policy. They should be as accountable as anybody else. And I would really hope that you would move this bill forward, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. And just for everybody, we have a long agenda here, and we're going to be done with it soon. And unless you're a legislator, you're only going to get about 3 minutes to talk on any one of these bills, because we're closing this committee down today. Mr. Shepard, you want to identify yourself first, and then I have a couple words to say.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General.
Thank you, sir. You know what, Senator, I couldn't agree more with everything you just said. The people of this state want this. The only thing between the people of the state getting this or not getting it is us, elected officials. With that, open questions, Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you. A couple of questions, if you'll indulge me. I don't know who could answer, but one of them, I think, Mr. Shepard. How do you enforce this for out-of-state companies is one of the questions that I have, and the other is, what's the purpose of grabbing the line? Why do they do it? Those are.
I can do the second one, and then maybe Mr. Shepard do the first one. In unscrupulous utilization of this technology during the heat of a campaign season so that other people cannot call the subscriber, or you can't call out and have any other type of contact. That's how it's been used. It was a real problem in the state of Florida where sometimes those would last for hours and hours on end. This makes that limitation that it can only be 10 seconds.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the short answer is this bill would be enforceable, as it's proposed to be amended, would be enforceable through the state's Unlawful Trade Practices Act, our basic consumer protection tool. And we've actually had very good success having extraterritorial effect, out-of-state effect of enforcement actions. Sometimes you run into arguments that the company hasn't done enough to make it itself subject to our jurisdiction here in Oregon, but those are, frankly, rare.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions of these nice Representative Smith?
I just had a comment, Mr.
Yes, ma'am.
Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill. Just this session, I had I call home to check messages, and I had a message from someone telling me to call Representative Patty Smith and gave out my number. And I went home and checked the caller ID, and I couldn't check it. No number. So I thank you very much. I'm on the no-call list, too.
Representative Esquivel, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with my colleagues here, Senator. I received some robocalling this session where it appeared that I was speaking to the people and told them to press 1 to be in touch with me to give them feedback on a specific issue, and I had no knowledge of what was going on other than the fact that I had 1,200 calls on one issue, which really makes my wife happy.
Representative?
Mr. Chair, gentlemen, would this bill prevent that?
Yeah.
That's an important question.
Well, it would depend, Mr. Shepard, on who that individual was.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, Section 4 of the bill prohibits making misrepresentations during the call about the caller's identity. So if someone had misrepresented his identity, I should say Section 4 of A. and Gross Senate Bill 863, and I'm sorry I don't have the corresponding reference in the amendments because I haven't seen the amendments, but assuming that they're identical.
They are.
Section 4 of A. and Gross Senate Bill 863 prohibits misrepresentations or falsification of the caller's identity or the identity of any person on behalf of whom the caller is making the call.
The only thing different is the removal of the emergency clause.
Yes.
Any, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for anybody, and that is that on page 2 of these dash 5 amendments, at line 17, this is in section 4, there seems to be a list of exceptions to when the bill would apply. And it says subsection 1 of this section does not apply to a caller in the following circumstances. And on line 17, it says the subscriber owes a debt to the caller. So is this saying that collection agencies or companies that I have credit card with and an outstanding bill, or any other company that I might owe money to, car dealership, whatever, could then still make robocalls to me under the language of this bill?
Yes, Representative Rosenbaum. This issue was brought to us by the debt collection industry early in our session, and that is that if, in fact, they do use these to collect lawful debts, to advise people that they have a debt and, you know, a need to call or to make arrangements for it. And after kind of figuring out how to actually put that in the bill, it was decided that the best way, I think, actually working with Mr. Shepherd on this too, where we changed this bill is to say if the call is for a lawful debt collection practice, that they could still use that. And one could, you know, argue the merits of that. I mean, they actually owe a debt. But in the larger scheme of thing, quite frankly, it wasn't worth fighting the debt collection industry over that particular issue. I mean, it was not the major issue that people are concerned about. So, yes.
Well, follow up, Mr. Chair. It seems like these debt collection calls could be made by live people rather than by automated equipment.
Right.
I don't
really... Well, I think I'm not an expert in the field, Representative Rosenbaum, but as the testimony was that in early stages of debt collection, they will often just send a robocall saying, Representative Edwards, you're 30 days late on so and so, please, you know, remit immediately. If it goes beyond that, as you know, they do use live people to call, and which would this not be affected by?
And then another question, Mr. Chair, and I think this is for Mr. Shepherd. I actually have just been given a copy of a letter from Legislative Council, which went to, it looks like, both the majority and minority leader, and I'd be happy to provide copies to the committee, but I haven't been able to digest it because it was just provided to me. But the letter seems to suggest that this bill might well be ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court under Article 1, Section 8 of Article 1. So do you have any opinion about that? And I would ask you particularly in light of the fact that apparently debt collection agencies can still make these calls, but, you know, Susan G. Komen Foundation couldn't.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, first of all, it's absolutely correct that this bill will be attacked under Article 1, Section 8. There's no, can't gainsay that. That's going to happen. And the existing, Oregon has had, since 1989, even on the statutes, a purported prohibition against the use of automatic dialing devices, and that prohibition indeed was declared unconstitutional by the Oregon Supreme Court some years ago, on the basis of Article 1, Section 8, which is the part of our Constitution that protects free expression. The law with respect to the application of that part of our Constitution is the general line within my 3 minutes.
You have more than 3 minutes.
Is that laws that address the expression itself are vulnerable under Article 1, Section 8, and very likely will be declared unconstitutional, as the prior version of the law did. Laws that address the harms that are caused by expression are permissible under Article 1, Section 8. I think that you have correctly identified one of the vulnerabilities of the bill. That is perhaps the most vulnerable part of the bill. Nevertheless, our office believes, and we've looked at this through our Solicitor General's office as well, we believe that this bill is defensible. And we worked with the Senate to craft a bill that focused on the harms. Our contention with respect to debt collection, and admittedly, this, as I say, I would tell you frankly, that is the most vulnerable part of this bill. Our contention with respect to debt collectors is that the consumer in that case has entered into a voluntary transaction with the person to whom the debt is owed. And thus, we would argue in defense of that exception that is not an exception based on the content, but rather upon the harm that's caused to the individual, which is distinct. That is to say, that isn't harmful for the consumer who has entered into the business transaction with the person who gives rise to the debt collection. I should say that we did not draft those amendments on the Senate side, just to be clear about the record on that, that those were, in fact, offered by the debt collectors.
Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the bill as well, and I noticed that you, in Section 5, you're discussing that it's not that a caller may not use the automated system to make calls to cellular phones, mobile radio, basically the wireless industry in its entirety, and sort of treating them differently than you're treating the hardline industry. So I'm kind of wondering what the reasoning for that is as far as treating that segment of the industry differently. And a second part of that question is there not already some, or is there any consumer protection already available to folks to file up and make complaints about automated phone systems and unwanted solicitations?
Let me handle the first one. I'll ask Mr. Shepherd to handle maybe the last one. The reason it is specific to, again, addressing the harms, as Mr. Shepherd has pointed out, is that currently, and this could change in the future, but currently most wireless plans, you incur a charge for each minute that you're actually on that phone, or under your plan you have 1,300 minutes and it's so much per minute, or when you retrieve a message, that you're going to see that on your bill, that you actually had to pay to do that, as opposed to Hardwire, in which you have universal service and you have a flat fee. So you can pick up your phone at home and talk to as many people who have called you, and you do not incur an additional cost, and therefore there is no harm. The harm is on the cellular phone, where you're now paying 10 cents or 20 cents to listen, as opposed to the hardline, in which there is no additional cost. So it's not really treating them differently, other than the industries are differently and how they assess charges. If the hardline changed and all of a sudden they started charging you, then it would fall under the provisions of the bill.
Follow up with that, but at the same time, don't both services charge you for a usage fee or a tax as such, whether you're hardline or wireless?
Well, it doesn't charge you additional. See, that would be the harm, is that when you have a landline and it's, say, it's under federal regulation for and state regulation for the universal service, for basic, what they call basic wire service, basic phone service, whether it's $12.95 or $13.95, you don't incur an additional cost for picking up the phone for people who call you. That's the major difference. If that rule changed and all of a sudden now wireless companies came here and you and my committee and the legislature changed the law and said, okay, hardline is going to be treated like a basic service, is no longer basic service, and it's going to be by the minute, then it would be maybe reciprocal with this bill. But under the fact that the federal government has determined that everyone has a right to basic service, that does not incur an additional harm.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, in the language of the bill, the key with respect to paging and answering services and the cellular services that you described, the key language is that if by calling that number, the caller causes the subscriber unwanted expense. So the text of the bill supports the interpretation Senator Metzger has placed on it, which is it's the imposition of an incremental cost for that contact. That's the harm that's addressed in those contacts. With respect to your other question about whether there's a general prohibition or consumer protection that bars unwanted or uninvited solicitations, the general answer is no, except such as might be attached to the no-call list, for example.
Any further questions?
Just one more.
Thank you.
And I guess this is for either the Senator or Mr. Shepherd, but in the list of exceptions on page 2, and this is the one on line 15 and 16, the bill also has an exception for any business with which the caller has an established business relationship. And I guess what I would ask is, does this mean any business with whom I have been a customer or done business in any other way? Because that would seem like a loophole you could drive a truck through. I've got a charge account at Sears. I have a charge account at Meyer and Franks. I have no idea who I've done business with, you know, over the last several years.
Mr.
So
Chair,
would any of them be able to make automated phone calls to me?
Representative Rosenbaum, the in section one of the bill, the phrase established business relationship is a defined term, and it provides that it means a previous transaction or series of transactions between a caller and a subscriber that occurred within the 18 months preceding a call. That provides some guidance as to what that relationship would be in order to qualify. But that's the only definition that's provided in the bill.
So just to follow up, Mr. Chair, does that mean that if I had communicated with some business over the Internet in the previous year and a half, that they would be able to say that they had an established business relationship with me?
Mr. Chair, Representative, on the text of the bill, I think so. If those interactions constituted a transaction, and the ordinary meaning of the word transaction would probably be how the court would interpret that, and I suspect that would be interpreted to mean a completed transaction, not just a contact. But I think the answer to your question is, if you had purchased something from eBay or somebody or over eBay with someone, business entity could contact you within the 18-month period.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
My pleasure. Any further questions of these gentlemen? Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Chair.
I'm going to call Justin Black and David Williams. Let's be concise, gentlemen. We've got a long day ahead of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Justin Black from the Oregon Education Association, representing over 47,000 members in the education field.
And may God bless every one of them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to touch on a couple things. I think there's some really good stuff in this bill, requiring disclosure, banning companies from misrepresenting who they are and their caller ID. I think, in fact, you could go farther and limit the times in which people can make these phone calls. I think also banning people from disconnecting after 10 seconds. I would say, though, the way the bill is currently structured, it penalizes many of the smaller campaigns that we take part in, such as school bond and levy campaigns, which are run on a budget of about $5,000 to $10,000. And this is their main way of communicating with 50,000 to 100,000 voters in the district. And I would say that campaigns like the presidential, which we'll see in 08, this will have little to no effect on them because they will just switch over to call centers and paid phone bankers to do these calls for them at a higher cost, which little campaigns can't afford. They'll also have the technology to scrub cell phones off their list so that they can still do these automated calls to your home line with no repercussions. But the little, county elections that get the phone numbers from the county elections and don't know whether these are cell phones or hard lines are the ones running the risk of getting the $5,000 fine. Was that quick enough?
That's perfect. Thank you very much. And thank you for being brave enough to come up and oppose this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. Just a second, everything my colleague said. Our concern does arise out of the shoestring budgets that local bond and levy campaigns do operate on, often getting donated lists of phone numbers or lists on the cheap, which may have inherent flaws in them that would conflict with the bill. Again, agree with the sort of intent here, but definitely concerned, looking at a local bond campaign that may spend 3 or 4 cents a call to do sort of automated calling, ideally during the daytime, to their voters to try to get out more information about a bond versus paying a dollar per call to a call center somewhere to try to make those very same calls. And on that, not much else to add.
Any questions of these fine representatives of our education system? Representative Burke.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to make a comment here as someone who has been deeply involved, in fact, chairing major bond campaigns. I just would like to say that we were very successful in getting groups of committed volunteers to come to phone banks and were given lists and they made personal calls, and it really worked great, Mr. Chair.
Been there, done that, and it's far more effective
yes,
to hear from
you.
Your neighbors. Any further questions, these fine gentlemen? Thank you. Would anyone else like to testify to Senate Bill 982 today? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 982, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 982. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the Dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 982.
Representative Esquivel moves Dash 5 amendments into Senate Bill 982. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative?
Thank you. I do have concerns about this bill, and I can't say what all of them are because I've just seen this letter from Legislative Council, but certainly at least looking at it, it raises questions about the bill's constitutionality. And these are questions that I think we actually could address given a little more time to work the bill and consider whether there are ways to apply this that wouldn't single out certain kinds of entities that can't make these calls versus kinds that can. I'm particularly concerned that under the language of the bill, a debt collection agency, which I can tell you, my husband, who has a common last name, frequently gets calls from when they're from the totally wrong person, can still make these, what I find, the most annoying kind of calls to my number, and yet, you know, some good nonprofit organization cannot. And also that any business that I've done any kind of business with in the last 18 months can still make calls. So I would prefer to see a bill that we considered over a longer period of time. I would prefer to see a bill that actually dealt with some consumer protection standards that have been considered in other bills in the building, particularly for wireless carriers or other things that are not in this bill. And so because of those problems that I have, I will not be able to support the bill today. Much as I know that this bill is near and dear to the chair of this committee, who's near and dear to my heart. But.
Well, thank you, Representative, and I just want to kind of respond that. Imagine if you're some poor bustard out there that got some payday loan and you can't keep up and some robocall calling you hounding for that money. You hang up the phone and the next ring is, "Hi, I'm Mike Schaffler. I'm the best thing since sliced bread. Vote for me." And my opponent's a deadbeat bum. Now, just think how that's going to make them feel. Anyway, that's my humble opinion. Representative Esquivel.
Does this mean that I am prohibited from pretending like I'm Representative Schaffler to initiate a beer bill?
One would hope so. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've listened carefully to arguments on both sides of this. This bill is a no-brainer to the people of Oregon. It is. I mean, and I don't care where you represent in the state, and I know if you represent my district in House District 14 that has been pounded by robocalls more than any other district. We had two really competitive races, my race and Senator Vicky Walker's race. And when it comes to campaign tactics, campaigning has turned into an arms race. And there's this escalation. And at some point, you step over the line with a violation of the public trust. The public knows that telemarketers cannot use these robocalls, but politicians have different rules. That's wrong, and I think that argument trumps any of the questions. And I understand there are good people on both sides of this bill, but that restoring that public trust and representing what our constituents want us to do here in this building trumps any argument against this bill, and I will oppose all efforts to I will support this bill and oppose any efforts to kill the bill.
Thank you, Representative. Any further comments? Kristen, you want to call the roll on the amendment, please? Just to
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Sewell.
Aye. Vice Chair Mulvey.
No.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum. No.
Chair Schaffler.
Aye. We adopt the measure. The Judge Feist, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 982 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 982 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holby.
I really appreciate the sentiment behind unwanted phone solicitation, but I'm very concerned that there's a lot of unwanted unintended consequences in this bill. And as such, not having a time to get this thoroughly vetted out with some of those consequences, I'm not sure how people are going to identify whether they're dialing a cell phone or not in this bill. I'm going to be a no vote on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. We've had opportunities to vet this in the Senate where it passed, and it's languishing in another committee for a lot of reasons, good reasons, I'm sure. But we're going to find out if this is constitutional. And I think that's what we're supposed to do here. And Representative Esquivel.
Yes, I just wanted to, thank you, Mr. Chair, to relay what Representative Edwards said. We're going to make about 57,000 people per district just happy as a clam at high tide when we pass this.
Any further discussion? Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I couldn't help resist. You're going to make my sister very happy.
Good. Any further discussion? I think we talk about cleaning up elections in this state all the time. We talk about it all the time. This is going to take some malice out of elections. It's going to make people, it will be a step in, as Representative Edwards very clearly pointed out, have just a little more trust in their government and how we do business here in the state of Oregon. Kristen, could you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 No.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
Would anyone like to carry this? Representative Esquivel.
God bless you.
I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 982. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 183A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we first heard Senate Bill 183A on last Wednesday's hearing. It extends the Rural Medical Professional Liability Reinsurance Program administered by SAFE through 2011. I actually am handing out to you right now -A16 amendments, which are consensus amendments between stakeholders that resolve some issues and provide some technical fixes to the Angross measure.
Thank you. And we have Senator Bates and Representative Ron Maurer. Gentlemen. And Corey Streisinger, you want to just come on up too, please? Whichever one wants to go first.
That's fine.
I think I'll just jump in there, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, I assume you all got the robocalls up about this last night. So you understand the bill now and the problem, right?
They said to call you.
We scheduled those for 3 a.m. in the morning so we were to get your attention, and I hope they were effective. What you're seeing before you, Mr. Chair, is the A16 amendments, and these are a compilation of the ones you've already heard about. We got them onto one page for you. These are things you've already heard about. There's a consensus already has been built around them. The first part of it is the attestation piece, which talks about making certain that all providers who will receive this benefit will keep their practices open to the level of Medicaid and Medicare that is in their county. The other section is about the nurse practitioners doing the low-income OB in Ashland. And the third part was a possible gap for the physicians in Grants Pass, a 6-month gap that might have been generated by the way the bill was written. So those are the three major pieces here. I also want to make it clear that when we say keeping someone's practice open, there's a little glitch in this that we did not want to put in the, we don't need to put in the bill, but I want to want the record real quickly. If you're an obstetrician seeing only obstetrics, or you're a pediatrician, especially in a rural area, the likelihood of you ever seeing a Medicare patient in your practice the entire time you're in practice is almost zero. There are a few children who have Medicare because they're medically fragile, but most of those kids are under a Medicaid program and they're not part of a Medicare program. There are a few disabled kids who might have a Medicare program. For the most part, a pediatrician would have no opportunity to ever see a Medicare patient. Similarly, someone doing just obstetrics would not be seeing a woman who was over 65 and pregnant. And if so, pay is the least of our problems here. So those, especially those two areas, those people will never be able to see them. The problem for them is that when you set up to bill patients of a certain category, there's a lot of expense and trouble to do that, especially Medicare. I mean, the Medicare bills go to North Dakota, of all places, are processed there in a huge center and come back, and it's just, let me tell you, it's just really a big deal to set up yourself up for a Medicare billing service. So these people, a lot of them will probably not set up a Medicare program in their office. Doesn't mean they're not open to it. It means it's almost impossible for them to do that. Very expensive to maintain year after year after year, when they're probably never in their whole career going to see a Medicare patient. So we just wanted that in the record, that if a physician chooses not to set up a Medicare billing system, they still have their practice open. They just never expect to see a Medicare patient in those special places. So I would say that you've got a long day ahead of you today, probably a longer day tomorrow. And this is a good bill, should pass, and I'd ask you to amend in the -16s. And as far as 183 is, call it a good day and let's get to the floor.
Thank you, Dr. Representative
Ron Maurer.
serving Grants Pass, and I have to state that I have an actual conflict in this bill, that my wife is a nurse practitioner and that our clinic would benefit from this bill, but the issue here is about rural providers, and rural providers come few and far between, and that anything we can do for physicians and nurse practitioners is a good thing for rural Oregon. I know in Grants Pass, even though we moved into an what you would technically call an urban area, it really is not an urban area. Our reality has not changed. The number of retired people in Grants Pass, Josephine County, is ever growing, and we do not have enough primary care providers. The bill is a work group consensus bill that everybody can support, the public can support it, and that we as a legislature can support it.
Thank you, Representative. Corey, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I just wanted to reiterate, as Senator Bates has said, that the Dash A16s include a resolution of the issues that were raised last time, and with these amendments, we urge your support for the bill.
Thank you.
Yes, Chair, I think I failed to identify myself. I'm Alan Bates, State Senator from Southern Oregon, District 3. Oops.
Everybody knows who you are, Senator.
Unfortunately, that's
<probably. laughs> Any questions of these fine people? All right, thank you very much. I don't have anybody else signed up, but anyone else like to testify Senate Bill 183A today? All right, seeing no one, I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 183 and open a work session on Senate Bill 183A. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we attach the A16 amendments to Senate Bill 183.
Representative Esquivel moves the Dash 16 amendments into Senate Bill 183. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So moved. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 183 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 183 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Ms. Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 All right. Would anyone like to carry this bill on the floor?
I will.
Thank you, Representative.
About Representative Maurer.
Would you like to? Oh, yeah, he has a conflict.
He has a direct conflict. Okay. I would.
So, Representative Smith.
He can speak to it.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. And we thank your wife for all the service she provides out there too. So, all right, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 183A. I can just start at the top. I'm going to open a public hearing on I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 506A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we first heard Senate Bill 506 on May 16th. Defines direct medical sequela as conditions that are diagnosed, requested by the injured worker, and accepted by the employer prior to the closure of claim for purposes of determining impairment in a workers' comp claim. You have in front of you a Dash A3 amendment which clarifies the intent of the measure. It establishes that during a reconsideration proceeding, if the medical arbiter diagnoses a direct medical sequela that has not already been accepted as part of the claim, the arbiter is required to identify the condition and send the report to either the insurer or the self-insured employer. It also requires the identified direct medical sequela to be processed as either a new or admitted medical condition pursuant to current statutes relating to the regulation of medical reports and claims for new and admitted medical conditions.
I'm going to have someone come up here and describe the amendment here. Who's volunteering to do that? And folks, here's what I know there's some objection to this bill in this committee, and I respect that completely. The amendment that we're going to hear does not solve the problem. Senators, I understand, it's been told to me that on good source, that Senators Prozanski and Senator Vakin, who are on the committee this came for, are willing to not concur with this amendment today that we're going to move, and then this is going to go to conference committee, and we're going to try and fix this. And that's what the process is going to be here. It's not very neat and clean, but it's our last day. Sir, go ahead and identify yourself and describe to us what we're...
My name is Ronald Atwood. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Self-Insurers Association. Thank you for the opportunity. What this bill does is allows an employer to process a direct medical sequelae before it is rated. As the issue comes up today, it comes up in the context of a rating, and an employer never has a chance to look at it. We're attempting to put together some amendments which will allow us to allow this process to work automatically. But what this does is it makes it a newer admitted medical condition claim. and allows the claimant to go forward with that. Mm-hmm.
Any questions of this gentleman? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr.
You're
Chair.
Welcome.
I just want to be clear about what this amendment does, because the language of this amendment basically says that if a medical arbiter who is not a doctor working for the worker but is a doctor who is supposed to be independently looking at this claim finds any condition that resulted from the original injury, that will be treated as a brand new claim that will be sent through the process of compensability. Just to finish my question.
Yes, please.
I just would like to hear your response about how this is going to either make the system work more speedily or not result in workers failing to get the benefits that are currently being paid to them until after they work their way through a whole process of a new opening of the claim, a possible denial of that claim, having to resolve that up to and including the appellate courts, and then go back to where things are originally happening, which is now. They're happening with no litigation whatsoever.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, when a worker is injured, there is a claim with the date of injury and a claim number. Within that claim, there are a number of subsidiary claims. The initial claim is a claim in the first instance. Later, they may file an aggravation claim. They may file an omotion claim even after that, depending upon what happens to them over time. Also, as part of this process, we have what are called new or admitted medical condition claims. And that was put into the statute to allow workers to advise an employer that we think that our claim is broader than what you had, what you've originally accepted. So at any time during the processing of the claim, something like this may occur. What occurs in the typical situation is a claim is filed. It's investigated by the employer. They have a chance to make an accept-deny decision. And then if it's accepted, benefits are paid. If it's not, then there's a chance to litigate that and to go through the process. What happens with these direct medical sequelae is that process is hijacked. A physician who is independent of both the employer and the worker makes a decision that they think the claim should be broader than what the employer has thought. When it arises, the employer is given no opportunity to make an accept-deny decision, and so that right to initially process the claim is denied them. And what happens in many of those cases, because the award is then higher than anticipated, that goes immediately into litigation, and it ends up sometimes, as you say, in the appellate courts. What this bill is intended to do is to restore the balance, to allow an employer to first process the claim, to make an accept-deny decision before it is rated. And that's really all it's designed to do. As it happens now, when these arise, the employer is given effectively no chance to rate it, to make a compensability decision before rating occurs. So this takes... The worker still has the right to move the claim forward, and if it's accepted, they will get their benefits.
Representative?
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the write-up on the bill that was done by the Workers' Compensation Department, and the example they give is if a worker had an accepted condition that resulted in surgery and there were post-operative complications, any disability resulting from the post-operative complications would be included in permanent impairment. Direct medical sequelae conditions are included whether or not the worker has requested the specific condition be accepted by the insurer. And so basically, you're saying that you would want conditions that came out of a surgery that went badly to have to go all the way back through a process of somebody applying for benefits all over again and then litigating whether that was part of the original claim or not? Because, this word sequelae, I think, has everybody bamboozled. It is not some arcane legal term. It just means things that resulted from the original condition that the person got benefits for. So what am I missing here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I think what you're missing is there's a distinction between conditions which we accept and the symptoms of those conditions. And typically the symptoms are broader than the condition themselves. And so let's take the example that we've talked about in the past where the person has the herniated disc that causes leg pain. The leg pain is a symptom of the condition. So when you've accepted the herniated disc, you get the benefits of the conditions that are caused by the disc.
Mr. Chair, please. If the leg pain is caused by the original injury, why should that worker have to go all the way back to the start of the process and file a new claim and start all over again? If the worker had a surgery, and as a result of the surgery, they end up with a body part paralyzed, why would you want them to then have to start all over again and file a new claim? That resulted from the original injury, or it wouldn't be covered by the medical arbiter when they were looking at a closed claim.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, nobody that is behind this bill wants to deny a worker whose condition is caused by an injury benefits to which they're entitled. That's really not the purpose behind this bill. Purpose of behind this bill is if a condition arises during the reconsideration process that's not already accepted in the claim, they want the opportunity to have a chance to look at whether or not that condition is accepted. And if it is, then benefits are paid. And if it's not, then they want the opportunity to have a chance to litigate it. The legislature in the past has told an employer that you must tell the worker what you are accepting. And so oftentimes the notice of acceptance goes right out to the worker. And if they say, and oftentimes it'll have a low back condition, oftentimes it's a lumbar strain, sometimes it's a herniated disc. If the worker also injured their knee, they have the right, and the legislature has adopted this, that they can tell the employer, I also want benefits for my knee. And that happens all the time, and that's kind of a regular part of this process. And sometimes that happens before closure, sometimes that happens after closure. But that, I mean, those kind of claims come in day to day, and you process it under the rubric of the main claim. The only difference is on each one of those claims, the employer is allowed to look at it first to say, is this related to the accident or is it not? And what happens with the medical sequelae is that the employer is not given that. And so it's really a matter of balance. You know, you start off with a proposition. A person files a claim. Employer processes it. If when they're medically stationary, you rate it. And that's we want to have that occur with direct medical sequelae, and that's not what's happening right now.
So just so I get this right, somebody herniates they have a herniated disc, but they also hurt their knee. But the knee injury may not be related to the disc. So you want to be able to address both those, but rather than in the rating system, they'd say, well, you're going to get X for your herniated disc and your knee.
That's right.
We're separating these out. Is there anything in here? Well, how does this benefit the worker? Is there an answer to that question?
I think the way, Mr. Chair, I think that the way it benefits the worker is that when these claims come in, there's kind of this feeling by the claims people that all of a sudden a claim that we thought was simply a back is now a back and a knee, and all of a sudden benefits are being paid and we've never had a chance to investigate it. Those claims go immediately into litigation. Whereas typically in the process, if the worker lets the employer know, I think there's a knee here, or if it arose under this process and the medical arbiter said, I think there's a knee involved here, we just want the opportunity to say, yes, we agree or we don't. And that cuts down litigation.
This will reduce litigation.
There's some litigation in terms of dealing with direct medical sequelae that will be not here.
And, Mr. Chair, please. Would it be...
It won't eliminate all litigation.
God forbid that would happen.
But
your testimony is that this will eliminate litigation for workers in getting benefits that they're currently getting, because I'm reading the department's analysis, and they say very clearly, since direct medical sequelae are currently considered when determining a worker's permanent impairment but may not always be rated with the passage of this bill, some workers may have reduced permanent disability benefits. Insurers would have a corresponding saving in benefit payments, which to me is saying workers are currently getting what they have coming to them under the reconsideration process, and under this bill, they will get lower ratings of benefits, and they will have to go through, if they can get a lawyer to represent them, a process of litigation to establish what they're currently getting without ever even knowing that there's a fight about it.
Excuse me, that's under that language right there. And if we can get this off the House floor and over to Floyd Prezansky, Senator Prezansky, for him not to concur to our conference committee, any new amendment, I understand, will go to MLAC and be heard again.
That's correct.
Now, quite frankly, that's my main argument for passing this bill today.
We've had.
You want to respond to Representative Rosenbaum?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum. We've had extensive conversations with the department as we've gone through this process. I haven't specifically read what you're looking at, so it's hard for me to respond to it. But we've had ongoing discussions, and to make sure that this is something that's fair to employers and fair to workers and does not take away from workers.
Representative Holley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember this testimony from before. I'm looking at these amendments, and I don't think these amendments are changing my original concerns that if the worker comes up and his knee is now affected and the doctor determines that this is a result of your accident, now it's on the burden of the employee to request a whole new process and actually has to file a new claim to get his knee covered under this bill instead of using the existing claim that he was under from the original accident. So to me, this is putting a lot more burden and a lot more process and a lot more hoops to jump through for the worker. And to me, that just is going the wrong direction of what the intent of the workers' comp system is supposed to be doing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I think there's a misperception here. Within the context of a single claim, there may be a number of claims. The statute specifically says that a diagnosis in a medical report is not a claim. And so oftentimes when a claims examiner gets a claim that they think is a back claim, there may be a diagnosis for a knee. But until, under the current statute, until the worker firmly says, please include my knee, and we call that a new or admitted medical condition claim, the knee isn't considered part of the claim. And so that's an existing process. And this, we're working, what we're trying to do is to work off the existing processes within the statute. But it's still part of the same claim with the same claim number. It's not as if they will set up a separate file with a separate claim.
We could beat this dog to death all day. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question of this witness, but I would like to hear from the department about this amendment.
Ms. Schultz, do you want to come and address that, please?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Schultz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And just a couple of remarks that I'd like to make. As Mr. Chair, you pointed out, I think many of us have just had about 24 hours, maybe a little bit longer than that, to look at the A3 amendments. There are some technical flaws in those amendments. There's language that I think has already been conceptually developed that addresses those technical concerns. So I think the technical issues in this bill in the A3 amendments are definitely able to be corrected. And as you indicated before, and I would state for the record that per my conversations with Senator Prezansky and Senator Avakian, they are committed to the conference committee process to work out some of the issues on this bill. One other thing I just want to add, be very quick on this, is just for the record, the Management Labor Advisory Committee has not looked at this amendment, nor any of the potential new language that could come in. We're working on setting up an MLAC meeting for this Friday to have them do that. So, and I'd be happy to answer any questions I can.
Representative, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schultz, I think, because I'm not sure that everybody was at our original hearing, could you just describe for the committee what a medical arbiter is and how they look at these claims in the course of a reconsideration?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum. I'll take a couple steps back, put it in the context of the benefit. When a worker suffers an injury or has an occupational disease that results in permanent disability, they're eligible for a permanent total or permanent partial disability benefit. And it's actually a technical look at the worker's range of motion, their actual impairment, the disability factors, and you add those things together, and there's a monetary amount that goes to the worker in compensation for their permanent impairment, permanent loss of earning capacity. Sometimes there is a disagreement about the original compensation amount for permanent disability. Either from usually the worker or even sometimes the insurer. It is the next step in the process is for reconsideration of the permanent disability benefit. That is done at the department. It's brought forward. It's an administrative dispute resolution process. We offer, by the way, mediation services to try to work those out, but many of those go through what is typically an arbitration process. And as part of that, a medical arbiter is hired by the department to take a look at the worker, examine the worker, and make findings for ratings of impairment. So that medical arbiter is someone who is not hired by either the worker or the insurance company or the employer. They're hired by the department. They simply make findings of impairment that are related to the worker's claim.
On that right there, I'm a worker. I got an injured back. I think my knee's part of my injury. I submit that. The employer says, no, it's not. Is that correct? They don't agree. Then it goes to the arbiter. The arbiter says, yes, it is. That's the final judgment right there. Or does the employer have the opportunity to go and litigate it further?
In that particular example, if the insurer or the employer has already denied the condition, we would specifically ask the arbiter not to rate that medical sequela. Because
then they go to court.
Because it is denied. The worker
and they have to go out and get a lawyer. The injured worker has to then, at that point, in under our process right now, has to go out and get a lawyer.
Yes. If they want to take it on by themselves. We can do that too, but they'd be well advised, I think, on a compensability decision, what that would be. Pretty complex set of factors to be represented.
And the proponents of this bill would change that. They would address each of them separately.
Under my understanding of what the proponents are trying to do is when the medical arbiter is the one who first identifies the medical sequela. That
I hate that word.
The bad knee. The condition that's related
you.
to the accepted condition. Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
That's right.
That when that's first identified by the medical arbiter, that they want a chance to examine that condition and make an accept or denial decision on that condition. Their concern is at this point in time they are not allowed to do that because the arbiter brings it into the claim. And it goes forward, as Representative Rosenbaum has pointed out, and benefits are processed immediately. That can be litigated further. However, you cannot bring – the record is frozen from the reconsideration process on. You can't bring in new evidence, and so it makes it more difficult for the employer to litigate on that issue.
And, Mr. Chair,
yes, please.
I know my memory might be rusty of the workers' comp reforms, but I seem to remember that the reconsideration process and the medical arbiters were part of the workers' compensation reforms that were meant to reduce litigation and to result in lower cost in the system. Am I misremembering that?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, you're absolutely right. The permanent partial disability area is a ripe litigation area across all jurisdictions. Most, you know, just anywhere you look, litigation rates as high as 30%
are usually occurring. And there was also a concept, for those of you who remember back to those days of that discussion, was of dueling doctors phenomenon, where both sides had to go out and hire physicians on both sides, and they would go at it in court and try to convince, rather than let's pick a disinterested third-party medical arbiter physician to make those decisions. Frankly, the system has worked quite well in reducing litigation, and I would submit it's not perfect, but it's a lot better than it was in 1989.
We need to wrap this up and have a vote. Any further questions?
Just one.
Yes,
Mr.
please,
Chair.
Representative.
I have heard, Mr. Schultz, that the department is taking a look at the entire reconsideration process just to evaluate how well it's working and whether it's fulfilling its intended purpose. Could the subject of this bill, given that we will be coming back here in February, be something that the department is looking at as part of that review?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, the Management Labor Advisory Committee has asked us to work with them during the interim on the reconsideration process and do a complete evaluation of that process. And yes, anything to do with that, with the reconsideration process, could be part of that review and evaluation.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We're under work session, right?
Yes.
I'll entertain a motion to adopt the A3s.
Yes.
Representative Esposito.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 506.
Representative Esposito moves A-3 amendments into Senate Bill 506. Is there a discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I object to these amendments. I mean, these amendments are flawed. The department has told us they don't solve the problem and that they are unworkable. And so I don't see how we can be adopting amendments that we know are not going to work.
And, Representative, you're exactly right. They don't work. The whole idea behind this, as I said earlier, is just to keep this idea moving in the system so we can make it better, if possible. And, once again, we're all going to have an opportunity to vote here. We're going to have another opportunity to vote on the floor. There's going to be a, if it passes there, which the proponents have their work cut out for them, if it passes there, it goes to conference committee. Well, we'll have another opportunity, and then we'll concur again. There's plenty of roadblocks in the way of it. I'm not going to beat around the bush. This bill has a tough road to hoe, a big hill to climb. And your objection's been noted. I share your concerns. Is there any further discussion? I will note Representative Rosenbaum's objection. Kristen, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Holby.
No.
Representative Smith.
No.
Representative
Rosenbaum.
No.
Aye, and I'll carry this on the floor.
Mr. Chair, I think that was just a motion to amend.
Oh,
you need to make a motion.
Forgive me. We're still open. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 506 is adopted to this House floor with a due pass recommendation.
As you can see, I'm ready to get this bill out and close
you
this committee.
Tell.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 506 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection or discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative, please.
Thank you. I think this bill has probably taken up more of our time than it should, but I'm going to speak to it one more time because I do think it's important that we not adopt this bill. The reconsideration process that is changed by this bill was a fundamental part of the workers' compensation reforms that the legislature adopted, and they have worked well, as the testimony we've heard has said. And what this bill is doing now is, instead of having a medical arbiter who is not picked by the worker or the insurance company, but is somebody who's independently looking at the claim, instead of having that person look at the injury and decide what should be included in awarding benefits at the end of the claim, now we're going to have things that medical arbiter, who's objective and not paid by either side, subject to litigation. And that, to me, is only going to cause more litigation in the system, which will drive up costs, and by the department's write-up of the bill, workers will get lower awards of benefits than they're currently getting and now have to go out and hire a lawyer in order to establish something that we're doing without having litigation now. And I just think this is really bad policy, and not just for workers, but this is bad for employers too. There's no reason why we want to make a system that has worked well and had low costs more litigious and drive things into a system of having to hire lawyers when we've got a system right now that uses doctors who are objective and does things in a way that that does it speedily and I think serves everybody. And furthermore, the department just told us that they're looking at this entire process and reviewing it so that if there is a problem in this area, they could look at it in the context of their overall review. So I just don't see what the rush is to get this bill out of here today, less than a month before the end of session. So I really strongly, strongly would urge the members to take a look at this bill, which I think is going to hurt injured workers and make the system more expensive, and that will be bad for employers too. And I would just urge the members to think hard and please to vote no.
Any further discussion? Representative Edwards.
I think Representative Rosenbaum has some legitimate concerns. I think that it is dishonest for any of us to think that anything we do with the workers' compensation system, reforms in the past, things we do in the future, is going to work perfectly for everybody. Because there are plenty of employers that are dishonest and abusive, and there are plenty of employees that are dishonest and abusive, and there are plenty of attorneys that are dishonest and abusive. And you know what? The physicians don't get off scot-free either. So we don't live in a perfect world. If everybody was perfectly honest,
we wouldn't have a job.
An objective. Yeah, we wouldn't need to be here. I'll support moving this bill out. I will continue to study the issue. If I change my mind, I'm reserving my right to vote no on the floor. And that's all I have to say.
Any further questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make the comment that I think we are moving this way too fast. I don't know why it wasn't heard before. We've only had one hearing on it that I've attended, and now we're trusting the Senate. It's going to be fixed on the Senate side. Well, that's one of my things. I've been here four terms, and somehow things don't get fixed. So I just wanted to make that comment, and I'll put it on the record.
Thank you, Senator Rippenstein. And it won't be fixed on the Senate side. Thank They're you. Not going to concur with the amendment. They're not going to the conference committee. But as far as moving too fast in a system that, you know, this legislature just moved out Senate Bill 838 and with the assurances that no rates would go up. Well, you know what? We don't know that, but a bunch of nice people voted for it. Now, I just some of the arguments that are used, I have conflict with. Representative Holby.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going on what I've heard in testimony, what I've read here from the department and all, and this bill just apparently looks bad for workers. I'll be voting no. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Kristen, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Representative
Berger.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
No.
Aye, and I'll carry this on the floor. Close work session on Senate Bill 506. Open a public hearing on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Public hearing on Senate Bill 253A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 253A allows an administrative law judge who mediates a workers' compensation claim disposition agreement to approve the agreement. The measure passed unanimously out of the Senate Commerce Committee, passed unanimously out of the Senate, and has the support of MLAC.
Mr. Moore, how are you?
Good afternoon.
And if you guys want to change your vote.
Thank you very much for taking the, I hope, 2 or 3 minutes to hear from me. Just real briefly, what the summary says it all. Claim disposition agreement is simply a way of releasing non-medical rights in a claim. A mediation is a settlement conference. Presently, claim disposition agreements must be signed by the Workers' Compensation Board. This simply allows the person who must be an administrative law judge and an employee of the Workers' Compensation Board to sign the agreement that was reached during their mediation. It's not a big change. It will simply expedite getting the settlement documents processed. It will expedite getting money to the injured worker and, frankly, just make things a little easier for both sides in that settlement conference. And with that, I'll answer any questions if you have any.
Any questions of Mr. Moore today? Well, you did a great job. Would anyone else like to testify to Senate Bill 253A today? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 253A and open work session on Senate Bill 253A. Entertain a motion. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 253A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Espinal moves Senate Bill 253A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen?
Aye.
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 Aye. Excellent work, Mr. Moore. Would anyone like to volunteer and carry this bill on the floor? Well, thank you, Representative Smith. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 253A. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 688A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 688A clarifies that taxi cab drivers are considered as non-subject workers under the workers' compensation insurance coverage requirements if they lease a taxi cab by the shift or for a longer period or is under a contract to a third party for providing the transportation of designated passengers or to provide errand services. The bill passed unanimously out of the Senate Commerce Committee and also passed unanimously out of the Senate. And at the March 16th MLAC hearing, it was determined that they did not need to take a position on the measure. So just to let you know about that. You have in front of you a dash A4 amendment which clarifies the intent of the measure. It deletes Section 1, Subsection 15C from the measure, which pertains to the taxicab drivers being considered as the non-subject workers, and creates a new subsection which clarifies the criteria.
I'm going to call Charlie Williamson, Steve Antler, and David Swither. I hope I got that right. And guys, if you could keep it concise and to the point, you make me really happy. I know that.
We'll do it. Mr. Antler has stepped out for just a second. Charles Williamson, I'm an attorney and a lobbyist for Radio Cab. Steve Entler is the general manager for Radio Cab. David Wyther is a driver and a lobbyist for Radio Cab. I've passed out what this bill does briefly is it just clarifies existing law to make it clear that shift lease drivers, people that lease a cab by the shift, whether it's for the day, week, year, that they are still non-subject employees under, they've been treated that way under current law for years. And also, if they're a shift lease driver and they're carrying out a contract with a school district or medical, non-emergency medical transportation contract with TriMet or transit agency, that doesn't make them subject workers simply because they're carrying out that contract. We've worked very closely with the SAFE and the Oregon Transit Authority, TriMet. Everybody is about... We're in favor of this bill. The Oregon Transit Authority is in favor of this bill. Chair Schaffer wanted us to be sure the governor wouldn't veto the bill. We put together this little petition that we got about 300 drivers to sign in about 4 days. And the governor said that he would sign with him. We went to the MLAC. They didn't take any. They said this doesn't govern how the workers' compensation system works. It just covers, it's on coverage. So they said that it wasn't within their purview that they want to look at it. So we worked with SAFE. We finally got these amendments out of LC today, the A4 amendments. SAFE feels that this is the best, and the DOJ feels that this is the best way to achieve what we want to achieve. And so we're all in favor of the amendments. SAFE doesn't have a position on the bill, but they don't oppose it, and they've been very helpful with these amendments. That's all we have. We'd be glad to answer your questions.
Go ahead.
That's all of our testimony.
Oh, that's all your testimony. Any questions, these gentlemen? Okay, thanks, guys. Mr. Davies, would you please come on up here and help us out?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chris Davey of SAFE Corporation. I suspect you'd like the Reader's Digest version of this bill. We have not taken a position on this because we don't take positions on who should be subject to the workers' compensation law. We think that's up to the legislature to decide that. The issue that this bill addresses is the owner drivers of taxi cabs, and the reason the bill is before you is because there have been disputes over the years about whether an owner driver, based on the unique contractual relationships between the cab companies and the drivers, whether they fall under the existing exemption from the workers' compensation law. Those relationships have changed, and so we've got into disputes over whether premiums should be paid, and in some cases workers have filed claims that were initially denied and then found to be compensable. So what this bill does is really bring the language up to date with those existing relationships. And It's, as far as I know, and you've heard from the cab companies, there are no cab drivers who are objecting to this. The bill was not really reviewed by AMLAC. They decided to let the legislature make that decision. And so we've worked with the cab companies on trying to get a bright line that will determine whether these people are in or out of the workers' comp system, and that should resolve the outstanding disputes. I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
And the way I understand it, these taxi cab drivers are all independent contractors who have their own insurance themselves and don't get wages or salaries or anything like that. And if they have to, if we force them to pay workers' comp, it's incredibly expensive due to the unusual risk they take. And that's why there's no objection from these owner drivers. That's the way I understand it.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just make one correction. They're not generally considered to be independent contractors in the way that the statutes determine who is an independent contractor, because they don't really work for anybody else, and they are under the direction and control of the cab company. So the statute says you're a worker, but you fall under one of the exemptions that says that you're not part of the workers' compensation system.
And hence my skittishness in asking the governor and MLAC. Anytime that anybody says independent contractor, it's almost like workers' compensation. Okay, any further questions of Mr. Davey? Would you like to come forward and respond to what I just said, too, sir?
Yes, we believe they are independent contractors. They have licenses.
We don't need to argue about that.
We can argue about that. But they don't. They are covered by automobile insurance. They can get their own health insurance. Radio cab has a thing with Kaiser, but they buy it themselves. But that's the only insurance. I don't want you to be misled by that.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Representative Berger, go anywhere.
No, this is a question of staff on the dashboards.
Oh, thank you.
Yes. What did they do exactly?
One second. It changes the placement of the language and establishes the criteria for the taxi cab driver to be a non-subject worker from one portion of statute to a new subsection under the statute. And it also clarifies the terminology of a non-emergency medical transportation driver, and so it defines what that entails as somebody who works for a mass transit district, for example.
Mr. Chair, yes, I only ask because, you know, this came out of the Senate, and I'm just wondering how it came that there were flaws that led to these amendments.
That was my understanding, that the stakeholders wanted to make some further clarifications to the bill.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
We're under public hearing, right?
Yes.
Would anyone else like to testify to Senate Bill 688A today? You know what? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 688A. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 688A. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the A4 amendments to Senate Bill 688.
Representative Esquivel moves the dash A4 amendments in the Senate Bill 688A. Is there any discussion? Is there Representative Holby?
Sorry, Mr.
Chair.
Quite
right.
Well, you know, I'm just a little hesitant with this bill, you know, that technically they're not independent contractors from what I understand according to our state law, and therefore I feel like they're employees and ought to be covered under workman's comp, so I won't be supporting this.
All right, thank you. Any further discussion? We will note Representative Holby's objection. Would entertain a motion to.
What about the passing the adoption of the.
And voted
on the dash. 4 amendments.
Well, if you want to call a roll, we can. Kristen?
Aye.
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 No.
Aye.
No.
Aye. All right, Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 688. As amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 688A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure I know exactly what this bill does, but I am concerned that people that are providing medical transportation services under contract with a mass transit agency and could get injured are not going to be covered by workers' comp. It seems like if they're looking for TriMet or Eugene Transit or whatever, and they're transporting people and they get in an accident and they're taking people for medical care, they ought to have some coverage. So because I have doubts about that, I'll be voting no, and I'll reserve the right to discuss that with the proponents of the bill.
Very good. Thank you very much. So noted. Any further discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 No.
Aye.
No.
Aye. I'll carry this one on the floor, too. Close the work session on Senate Bill 688A. I'm going to open a... Open a work session on Senate Bill 342A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 342A allows a nurse or employee of the Department of Public Standards Public Safety Standards and Training who is retired under PERS to be employed full-time as either a nursing instructor or a training instructor without the loss of retirement benefits. At the first hearing last Wednesday, we were asked by the bill's proponents, by Senator Monica Sanderson, to remove the current Ways and Means subsequent referral. And the Speaker's office had asked for us to carry the bill over so they can look at the measure further. And we do have permission to remove the Ways and Means referral.
Great. Can we have a vote on that?
Yes, we do. Actually. Well, actually, Mr. Chair, what you can do is you can move the bill and add on to remove the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
I'll entertain a motion to do just that. Representative Escobar.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 342A to the floor with a due pass recommendation and remove the referral to Ways and Means. Yes.
Representative Escobar moves Senate Bill 342A to the floor with a due pass recommendation and to remove the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Representative
Aye.
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 Would anyone like to carry this wonderful bill? Representative Edwards, thank you very much. Close the work session on Senate Bill 342A. I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 404A. And folks, we're just moving this bill. We're not amending it with anything. That's what our goal is today. How long do we want to keep Mr. Campbell in the room? Okay. Anyway, is there any discussion on this bill? Teresa, would you describe
it? Yes, I can. Sure. We heard Senate Bill 404A last week. The actual bill allows for the payment of reasonable costs for records, opinions, and witnesses fees that are associated with appealing a workers' comp claim if the claimant prevails. It also caps a reimbursement for reasonable costs of $1,500 unless the claimant demonstrates extraordinary circumstances that justifies a greater payment amount. There was an A4 amendment that was distributed at the hearing, which wasn't really discussed. It adds further clarification to the bill that allows an administrative law judge or the workers' compensation board to grant the attorney, or actually requires to grant the attorney that represents the injured worker, a lien for recovering the fees if the worker has additional reward or compensation or proceeds of a claim settlement, and the injured worker has filed a what's called a a form that allows the attorney to represent them in the claim.
As long as it's not sequelae, I don't care what we call it. Any discussion on this?
Mr. Chair, I'll just point out that now when injured workers have their claims denied for conditions that used to be just included in the rating of their disability, and they have to get a lawyer to go appeal those denials, maybe they'll get a little help from this bill to pay some of the costs if they can find a lawyer to represent them. So
and God bless them.
We're doing some good today.
Any further questions or discussion? Thank you. Mm-hmm. Kristen?
All
right. We need to adopt the A4 amendment.
Excuse me. I'm entertaining a motion to adopt the A4 amendment.
I thought we weren't going to add any.
Yeah. The A4 amendment is from the Trial Lawyers Association, which are the chief proponents of the bill. And so they asked to have this add further clarification to the bill. The A5s were the ones that dealt with the cancer presumption.
We have some questions. Would you like the amendment described to us by these nice lawyers out here? Come on up.
Mr. Chair, the A4 was distributed at the last hearing, but we can make copies for you if you wish.
Can we retract my aye vote on the record? Make it clear that we haven't done anything
yet. We haven't done anything yet.
Yeah.
I said aye. Please, gentlemen, describe what we're doing here.
404A is the bill.
You have to identify yourself.
I'm sorry, I'm Martin Calvary. I'm a trial lawyer from Portland and a member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. 404A, the original bill, was the one that awards costs if you prevail on a workers' comp claim. The amendments that we're here to talk about today to move into that bill are the ones that create the lien. The Dash 5 amendments that we're dealing with firefighters' presumptions
No, we're not discussing that.
Are the ones you're not going to discuss today, as I understand.
So we're creating a lien on somebody who hasn't paid their lawyer who helped them get a workers' compensation claim.
That's what the amendment is.
Thank you. Sir, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Randy Elmer. I'm an attorney here in Salem, and I'm the person who drafted the Dash A4 amendments. Mm-hmm. What we're trying to do is encourage lawyers to represent injured workers, first of all, because they're unprotected. They don't have a statutory lien now for their time and efforts if they're fired. And we also have seen in recent years, I think probably with the advent of email and the less personal face-to-face contact that we sometimes now have with our clients, that clients are a little more bold, I think, when they can just send you an email and say, thanks for your hard work, and I appreciate you got a $28,000 settlement on the table, but I'm severing our service contract at this point, and we have no protection. We go without compensation at that point, and we just don't think that's right. And we'd like our lawyers to be protected when they represent workers under those circumstances.
And as my friend Representative Rosenbaum said, this, and I'm asking you, this will encourage lawyers to take these cases on, giving them some kind of protection.
Well, it adds some encouragement. I'm not sure there's a whole lot of encouragement now with our system the way it is to, for lawyers to represent injured workers, but this will help.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. Any questions, these gentlemen? And thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, would someone like to move the dash fours? Representative Espler.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we amend Senate Bill 404 to include the dash four amendments. Senate Bill 404A.
Representative Esquivel moves the dash four amendments in Senate Bill 404A. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. Representative?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 404A as amendment to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 404A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Kristen, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Representative Rosenbaum, would you like to carry this bill on the floor?
Mr. Chair, I'd rather not.
Okay. Anyone else? Someone like to volunteer to carry this bill. Representative Holby, thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 404A. And this is our last hearing, and it was an interesting one.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to do this before your closing remarks. So, I mean, I do want to do it before our closing remarks. So I want to serve notice of a possible minority report on Senate Bill 982.
Thank you very much. That's a good way to end the committee. Anyway, I just want to say thank to all of you. You've been wonderful committee members and very patient with me, and we've got a lot of work done. It's been my honor to be chair of this committee.
That's
Representative.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your hard work on this committee. I have really enjoyed it, and I particularly enjoyed the day, to tell you the truth.
It was a good day. Representative Esquivel?
Yeah, I think today's been fun. It's the first time in my life I've ever went out of my way to help an attorney, but I did today to protect them. I can't believe that we're protecting attorneys, that they can't protect themselves, but obviously we have a little hole in the law, so we plug that today. But I think you've done a great job.
Thank you.
Chair.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I want to add my congratulations for great committee work, and I truly enjoyed this. I asked to be on this committee, and it's well worth it. So
thank you. The Republicans love me. I should just close it right now.
Yeah.
Any further comments before the good of the order? Representative Edwards.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and fellow committee members. It's been an honor. And should we never serve on a committee again together? I've learned a lot. It's been an honor to work with all of you. I have a lot of respect for everybody here. And it was a great committee. Great committee.
Thank you. Anyone else have anything to say? Representative.
Yes, I can't say that I really enjoyed today's committee meeting, but that notwithstanding, it has certainly been a great experience to serve on the Labor Committee again. I was on this committee on my first couple of sessions, and not recently, and I can't say that I won't be seeing a lot of certain committee members in the weeks to come, but for those that I won't be serving with, it's been a great experience, and I look forward to working together with you in other capacities.
Thank you. Any further comments?
Mike, you can't leave me out. Mr. Chair, I guess, you know, I'm looking forward to Beer 30. So.
Hallelujah. And I particularly want to make note of the committee administrative staff here. Kristen and Teresa have done an outstanding job.
Here.
And I really, really appreciate everything you've done. All right, with that, we're adjourned.